श्रील गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय, ग्रंथरा श्रीमद् भागवतम की जय, श्री ब्रह्म स्तुति की जय, गौर भक्तवृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। गुड आफ्टरनून टू ऑल ऑफ यू, प्रणाम। Thanks for coming. Pranam to all the ones connected online as well. And here we are, continuing with our series of Sri Brahma Stuti, the prayers of Brahmaji to Sri Krishna after Brahma Vimohan Lila, or we could say still during Brahma Vimohan Lila, some other form of Vimohan is taking place. So today we are in meeting number 12. We will be studying verse number 10. So we are reaching some kind of 25% of the whole series. We have to begin somewhere. So today we will continue. I'll make a brief recap, of course, 10th verse, brief recap of last verse, 9th verse. And the topic will continue in the direction of devotional lamentation and what we term as crying yoga. So I hope you brought your napkins with you. So I'll briefly repeat the verse from last Sunday. My Lord, just see my wickedness. To test your power, I try to extend my illusory potency to cover you, the unlimited, unprimeval super soul who bewilder even the masters of illusion. What am I compared to you? I am just like a small spark in the presence of a great fire. So this is Brahma's realization at this point. Each verse is a level of realization, if you will. Brahma is learning pretty quickly. New insight, new epiphany after each one of them. And you can see that because in a few verses, as you will see, he will be praying to be born as something in Braj and so on. So pretty quickly he reaches that type of deep longing and so on. But again, at this point, Brahma is realizing a little bit more his apparatus. We spoke a little bit about that last class. We spoke that Brahma was realizing, okay, I did not only offended Krishna's form by considering it like a hoax, a fake aspect of my original guru, but he also offended the form of his friends and calves by trying to kidnap them. And somehow he was thinking, I committed also lila aparad because I interrupted the picnic. You know, I created this, or I tried to. You know, even though we know Yogamaya had other agenda, but he tried somehow. You know? So he's in deep spirit of repentance and lamentation. And we tried to share some words last week about how there is a place for that. You know? There is a place for everything in bhakti, actually. It's pretty much... The fact that bhakti is very user-friendly also is pretty challenging because, in the sense, if something is really user-friendly and somehow adapts to any situation, then we have the challenge of learning how to adapt every situation to bhakti. You follow? That's a challenge. I mean, the generosity of bhakti creates a generous challenge for us. It's generous. It's not a bad thing. But the fact that every single thing can be bhaktified, if you will, I mean, presents a challenge for us to, okay, how do I behave in such a way that I'm investing bhakti in every situation, in everything, in every act? Bhakti has that capacity. Now I have to develop that capacity also. I mean, the fact that bhakti has that capacity doesn't mean that we already have that capacity. So we are working in progress in that sense, basically. So we mentioned that point. You know, there is a place for lamentation. There is a place for, as Narottam Das Thakur will say, he's singing even about Kama, Krodha, Lobha, all these so-called enemies. But in one of his songs, he mentions how he can employ all the things in bhakti. You know? He can become really lusty in a transcendental sense, really desirous of attaining this, and he will become angry in a sustainable way with the enemies of Krishna, as one Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta say. Someone asks, what to do with anger. He said, you have to use that against Krishna's enemies. So he could perceive that in the audience they were like... So he said, but first you have to ask yourself, I am not an enemy of Krishna yet. Like making it clear in which direction is... And of course, angry towards ourselves means basically discipline. In a sustainable way, in a well-wishing way. That's anger. No? So we have to really work with these terms in every different generation, because every single generation carries a particular misreading of every single word in the dictionary, basically. And Gaudiya Vaishnavas are not exception to the rule. So we are also carrying a particular type of misreading of our Gaudiya glossary, second generation, third generation, for we have to properly upgrade the version to our particular situation needs. But again, there is place for, as we mentioned, healthy lamentation, not the extreme of neurosis, not the extreme of complacency. These two pendulums have to gradually, as Bhaktivinoda was saying the other day, at the beginning they're going like almost 360 degrees. And there are no extremes, actually, it's just like full circle. But at one point it will be like extremes, not like, okay, neurosis complacency, but eventually it's less neurotic, less complacent, okay, nishta. No? Or if you want to make it like the zigzag, anishtita bhajana kriya, up and down, today I think I may be a shakti abhisa avatar, just next day, as we said the other day, I'm breaking the six regulative principles, although there are four. No. And next day, who knows what, and eventually the undulation starts to become more and more fixed, nishta. But again, you won't reach nishta like this, and the next day like this. It doesn't work like that. It's like, gradually our life will become less and less embarrassing to us or something. Put it however you like, no problem. It's glorious. I'm not having fun at our present embarrassment. I mean, it's glorious in one sense. It's part of the process. I mean, Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur say that's in the context of Bhajana Kriya and Artha Nivritti. That's in the perimeter of bhakti. So that's under the shelter of certain glorious energies. So that's glorious. It's embarrassing in the context of glory. No? It's a glorious embarrassing. Again, not to go to the pendulum of complacency. Okay, glorious embarrassing. No. But there is a place for that. No? So anyhow, in this verse, Brahma, we are in the recap. I have to remind myself about that. In the verse of last week, Brahma was addressing Krishna with different names, and all of them were like kind of increasing in terms from Aishwarya to Madhurya, or also from like he said, Isha, you are God, Ananta, you are unlimited, Adhye, you are my father, then you are my guru, then Twayi, you are you, like you meaning Krishna is tu, Bhagavan Swayam, and then Maya Mayini, you are the master of Yoga Maya, which implies you are surrounded by associates made of Swarup Shakti, and like Rama is realizing all this stuff, which at the beginning of creation, it was too much for him. He saw Krishna, Gyan Mudra, some instructions, processing the Chatushloki of the Bhagavata, and that's enough for the beginning of creation. But now he's having this like expanded darshan, if you will. So he's realizing, okay. So I tried, there are different ways our acharyas mentioned it. Brahma tried to show his greatness, or Sanskrit can adapt to, Brahma tried to test Krishna's greatness. Again, Brahma doesn't know what's worse of the two. No? So whatever the case, he's embarrassed and he's praying with full humility. He uses the word anaryam. Remember, I behave in an anarya way, in a non-Aryan way. So basically he was, because he's concluding, I mean, you are the master of Yoga Maya, you are the master of all mysticism. Actually, I became mystified by trying to show my mysticism. And Krishna is not only Yogeshwar, but it's called Yogeshwareshwar. You have these names in Sanskrit, like Sarveshwareshwareshwar, or something like this. No? Generally, you can say Sarveshwar, but just to make the point clear, he's the controller of the controller of the controller, and you can put the word Ishwar like for 1 hour and still that's Krishna. So that was the conclusion of Brahma here. I have tried to mystify Yogeshwareshwar. I mean, it's like that's the most ridiculous thing someone can do, and I'm supposed to be the smartest guy in the universe. So again, Brahma is experiencing deep humility, deep lamentation, which of course takes him to take further increased shelter. And in today's verse, this humility of this verse is kind of overflowing and taking the form of the next verse, if you want to put it in those terms. No? Humility overflows in verse 9, and that becomes verse 10, an overflowing of the previous one. So today we will continue a little bit with this topic of crying yoga, if you will, or the art of devotional lamentation. But also, since last week there was some interesting discussion after the class, I mean during the class, but in the Q&A section on aparad and some considerations that are worthy of reconsidering, some points to make in that connection, but because we have been speaking also with the devotees after that, some important points. You know, this idea, for example, we have spoken that because of aparad, bhakti will go away. And remember, we were speaking with Bhakti Rasa, like, yeah, Bhakti is retiring because she's not pleased with our attitude. But it's not that she's angry with us or she's like revengeful, you say? Like, okay, you will never see my face again. Just suffer eternally in hell or whatever. You know? But Bhakti is leaving because, we could say Bhakti is retiring out of compassion so we don't keep committing more offenses to Bhakti. So we are doing something that is not good, so Bhakti retires, so we cannot just like drown ourselves more and more in that direction. Because if we are attacking Bhakti, okay, Bhakti retires, so we no longer attack her, basically. And the reaction that is coming to us, again, is not related to Swarup Shakti. Again, it's not that Swarup Shakti is chastising us or something, but it has to do with Maya Shakti, because of course, in order to engage in aparad means Maya Shakti is influencing you. You are not committing aparad under the shelter of Bhakti Shakti or something like that. So you follow my point. I mean, you are under the shelter of Bhakti Shakti, but when you choose to engage in aparad, you are attacking that shelter. So you cannot say, I am under the shelter of Bhakti Shakti while attacking Bhakti Shakti. For attacking Bhakti Shakti, you have to be in some other quote-unquote shelter, Maya Shakti, which is called sometimes Durashraya, which means quote-unquote shelter, so-called shelter, false shelter, actually. And the reaction that will come because of aparad, again, it's important to, again, each generation requires their particular way of speaking about this. It's not coming in a chastising spirit, like, okay, I will make you suffer so much now, and revengeful, you say, or vengeful? What's the word?
Vengeful.
Okay. So it's more in an educational spirit. Now, reactions, whatever you want to speak in terms of aparad, you want to speak in terms of karmic reaction, different situations, it's important that we get accustomed to think of them. This is educational. Now, there is a well-wishing intention behind this, as Guru Maharaj will say, tough love. No, it's not just chastisement for the sake of chastisement or what to speak of eternal hell or something. It's a constructive educational law, basically. There's not like, yesterday we were speaking, I think, about this notion that some Christians may have, and not only Christians, of eternal hell, even some Vaishnavas, not in our tradition, but in other sampradayas like Madhva Sampradaya or Balab Sampradaya. They won't speak about eternal hell as a destination to attain, but maybe even worse, they will speak about certain jivas who are eternally damned without a chance for getting redeemed ever. So, at least in Christianity, you have one chance, one lifetime. But my point is, in this case, when we as Gaudiyas relate with the reactions to whatever, aparad or sin, whatever, there is no, it's not that we have to think of them as a self-perpetrating loop that is like throwing us to further sin and further aparad, and therefore there's no chance to get rid of that, and therefore some eternal hell actually we need as a corresponding destination for loop. It's not like that. So actually, on the contrary, you know, eventually, as the case of Brahma is showing here, engagement in a prohibited act, whatever it may be, will end up, at some point, maybe not immediately, maybe not in one day, but engagement in a prohibited act will end up in the devotional act of supplication to Bhagavan. That's what Brahma is doing here. So again, aparadha is not the end of the story, as we say the other day. It's not like, okay, cut the movie there, finish. Aparadha, that's the end. No. That will take, at some point, it may take some seconds, minutes, hours, days, week, months, years, lifetimes. But at some point, this shift will be there, and the reaction will take as well, pushes will come with the intention of inviting us to this, to engage in bandhanam, to engage in prayer to Bhagavan, if you will. So that's the bigger picture of the aparat story, if you will, and not just you are offensive. No? Because sometimes it may be helpful for us to update the terms, how we use the term. Because again, as I mentioned, each generation has their own baggage or trauma, like semantic baggage. No? If I tell you, it is offensive to the soul, for many it's like, something activates subconsciously because they have heard that word so many times in so many ways, I mean, in so many times in the same way, pointing to a particular direction, and the word offensive may carry a very heavy generational, again, baggage that actually is not the intention of the one maybe mentioning the word or the meaning of the word, but it creates that emotional like reaction, whether it may be guilt, as Atmananda say, like guilt trip, or it may be a whatever, no? Like defensive mechanism. No, don't come with me with that stuff, you whatever. So sometimes we may need to replace it, and with this I'm not just taking you from neurosis to complacency, but just even a more literal translation of the word aparat. Aparat doesn't mean offense, etymologically speaking, for example. As we know, aparat means to go against love. So instead of telling you, I don't know, Amal Shyam, you are an offender. It's a heavy label, right? He's an offender. Especially if I speak in third person in front of him. He is an offender. But no, I can be more user-friendly. Say, Amal Shyam, you want love in your life, right? Do not go against love. I'm saying the same thing. I mean, that's because aparad means if you want love, it will be natural that, as Gumaras will say, you will avoid those things that do not fit with that idea. You won't go to, you don't, if you say I want love, you won't go against love, basically. About that thing that you want so badly. It's, in that sense, you present that it's common sense. So maybe it's better to present that, okay, it's common sense that we want love, we won't go against love. That's one way of saying, maybe to replace, you are an offender. And be ready for the consequences of, and so on. Instead of that, again, anukulyasankalpa pratikulyasavarjanam. We want to fall in love with Krishna, we'll try to follow those things that are favorable, to avoid those things which are unfavorable, and we realize we engage in some of those, well, there is always room for improvement. So as you can see, in many cases, some grammatical, semantic reconsiderations will be much more helpful than any philosophical explanation. Sometimes we need to adjust how we say something and it's like, whoa, that makes a whole difference, and it's just a word because so much is being carried in a particular word. And of course, aparad is not the exception to the rule, so many. So it's a good exercise. Every generation did some like recalibration of our glossary and how we are understanding those things. Anyhow, let's go to today's verse. to verse number 10. Let me share it here. One second. So this is the verse. I'll read it first in Sanskrit. In Upajati Chanda, it's a 12-syllable meter. It says, Attakshama satchitame rajobhubo hyanjanatastat pritagishamaninaha ajavali pandatamanda chakshasaha esho nukampyo mayinathavamiti. So, translation. Both translation says, Brahma is saying, remember, this is an overflowing from the previous one. Therefore, so that's some connection with the other one. That's why I made such a long introduction, only because of that, so you can connect. Therefore, O Achyuta, kindly excuse my offenses. I have taken birth in the most mode of passion, and I'm therefore simply ignorant, presuming myself a controller, independent of you. My eyes are blinded by the thick darkness of false pride, which causes me to think of myself as the unborn creator of the universe. But please, see me as subordinate to you, and therefore worthy of your compassion. So, there is hope, as you can see. So, I'll briefly share the word by word. You have them in your WhatsApp group?
Yeah. I sent it.
Okay. So we did our part. If you want to follow, I will just briefly mention that. So the first word in the verse is attaha. Attaha means like therefore. The different words like that, tasmat or others, like connecting previous statements with this one. So attaha means therefore. So again, it's showing this thread between these verses. Kshamasva. Kshamasva means basically, forgive me. Brahma is speaking to Krishna. Therefore, forgive me. Remember, Brahma is not just speaking like casually or like officially, like, forgive me. He's at the throne, at the soil of Braj, crying with the foreheads, bathing Krishna's feet in sincere repentance, and from that place asking, please forgive me. Like feeling, if you don't forgive me, nobody else can forgive me, and if I'm not forgiven because of what I did, I cannot see any prospect whatsoever in the next 5 seconds in my life. Something like this. So Kshamasa, and he connects very intelligently, he's like, Kshamasa Chyuta. So he calls Krishna again. Many times he's calling Krishna with this name, Achyuta, which means infallible. And especially, as we mentioned, he who never fails in showing mercy to his dependents. So Brahma is crying and worried, but he's intelligent. In the midst of his emotional outbursts, he is also knowing what to say, how to address Krishna. No, please. I have failed in every single possible, every way I could fail, I failed. So to make up for that, I need someone who never fails, basically. I'm Chyuta 108%. I'm fallible from tip to toe, Brahma is saying. So I need someone who is infallible to compensate this situation, this lacking of mine. All the things are implying the word Achyuta. Me then means my, which refers to my offense. Please, oh Achyuta, forgive my offense. Rajabhubha, this is an interesting word. Again, we are here with the general meaning, then we will go to some other implications. So Rajabhubha means whose place, bhuva or bhuvi means like land or earth or place. So Rajabhubha means whose place is Rajaguna, which is another way in Sanskrit of saying who have been born there in Rajas. Brahma is representative of the principle of Rajagunas, you know. Creation, action, desire, and so on. If we speak in terms of Trimurti, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and so on. Then he says he. That's an interesting word, which means indeed, but we will see how our acharyas explain it. Second line. He, ajanatas. So ajanataha means being ignorant. Jana means with knowledge. Ajanata means without knowledge. So he's speaking about himself, how he was born in Rajas and eventually covered by tamas, which ignorance has to do with that. Then he says, Tvat Prithak, separate from you. He starts now to explain what's his ignorance. And of course, the immediate definition of avidya, or lack of proper education or knowledge, is to conceive ourselves separately from our source. That's like the landmark of an ignorant person. And from there come so many byproducts of that. But the very foundation of ignorance is I see myself as independent from my source. And then he further clarifies that idea by saying, Isha Manina. So, Isha Manina. Manina means, like the verse in the bottom, which is Jenyera Vindaksha Vimukta Manina. So Manina is considering oneself. And here says, Isha Manina. So I not only was born in ignorance and being without knowledge, and Tvat Prithak, consider myself separate from you. Of course, the implication is Isha Manina, presuming myself a controller. I have no controller, I am the controller. I have controlled stuff under my jurisdiction. And again, we could say, well, for Brahma, he has a license to fall in that. And he's a pretty big guy, so it may be easier to think, okay, I'm pretty much talented. But it's much more embarrassing. Like, we don't have, with some luck, we have one useful head. No? And sometimes we feel I'm the center of the multiverse. Even not even this only universe. So Brahma has some license. I mean, I'm joking. He shouldn't have license, and he feels I shouldn't, but he himself is feeling this. So the implication is kaimutyanyaya, if you want to apply kaimutyanyaya, which means what to speak of. If Brahma failed in this, I mean, how much more embarrassing is that we feel ourselves as Brahma or more without being a Brahma? Anyhow. Then comes third line, Aja. Aja means one who is unborn. So somehow Brahma is unborn, but actually he's not unborn at the same time. He has a source, but he mentions here, I consider myself unborn. Aja, avalipa. Why? Avalipa means because of false pride. This took me to see myself in this particular light or in this particular shadow. Andatama, by such dense darkness, andachakshusa, whose eyes are blind. So basically he's depicting in detail his condition. I was totally blinded by a very thick layer of darkness. No? It all began in Rajagun, but it all ended in Tamagun, something like this. Which is generally many times the sequence, if you don't know what to do with Rajas, how to dovetail, if you will, that energy, it can put you down. And the last line says, Eshaha means he, Anukampya. I mean, he refers to himself, to Brahma. Anukampya, what does it mean, Anukampya? What does it mean, Anukampa? Tate, Nukampa, Sushamikshamano. We saw the other one. Anukampa, Anugraha. Anugraha, no? Karuna?
Mercy.
Your daughter, but something else?
Mercy.
Mercy. So all these words are the same thing. Anukampa, Anugraha, Karuna, Kripa, and so on. This is a nice thing with Sanskrit and the difficult one. For one same word in English, you have 108 words in Sanskrit. Huh? And for one word in Sanskrit, 108 different meanings also. So Anukampya in this case means worthy of being shown compassion. So Anukampa is compassion, and Anukampya means someone who is worthy of being shown compassion. So today we're also speaking about that. Now, what makes us worthy of mercy? Because Brahma is using that expression here, worthy of your compassion. Mayi natavam, which means how Krishna should think about Brahma. Mayi natavam means a dependent in relation to me. So Brahma says, Krishna, you should think of me as such. Oh, this Brahma is a dependent in relation to me. Therefore, you should show your compassion. Iti is the last word, means thus. Thus thinking in this way, please bestow your mercy upon me. Anyhow, let's continue with Bhaktivedanta Bhavanubhat, our Guru Maharaj's commentary. Relatively short, one paragraph on this verse, and then we will try to unpack some further considerations following other commentaries as well. So, Guru Maharaj says like this, having acknowledged his offense, Brahma then appeals to Krishna's compassionate nature, begging for forgiveness. So he's a beggar here. Speaking to Nirguna Krishna, he describes himself as the locus of Rajaguna, who in this instance is also influenced by the darkness of Tamaguna, giving rise to false pride. Avali Panda. But despite his fallen position before he who is infallible, Achyuta, Brahma nonetheless asserts that, in terms of his position as Brahma, he is Krishna's servant, an Adikritya Das, and thus worthy of Krishna's compassion. By referring to Krishna as Achyuta, Brahma implies that Krishna never fails to show compassion to his servitors. So that's Guru Maharaj's commentary on the verse. Mm. So basically, yeah, the implication is, again, Brahma is saying, you are infallible. Haridas Thakur also prays like this. There are many types of prayers in our tradition like that. Like, you are infallible and I'm infallible. That's our relationship. That's Sambandha Gyan. What is what? Who is who? You are Achyuta. I'm the exact opposite of that. So we complement nicely. You are a giver of compassion and I'm worthy of your compassion. So that's a perfect combination. That's how intelligently our acharyas have prayed. Not like saying, okay, if you want to retain your title as the most merciful, then you have to show mercy to the most fallen one. And you know what? I happen to be that one. If you don't show your mercy to me, that title will be taken from you. This type of like tricky prayers. I mean, you have to know how to pray. There are many ways. I won't go into that direction. That may take too much time. But there are some nice stories in Mahabharata, Ramayana, in different places where from one single prayer, so many things are accomplished. So you have to learn how to pray in such a way that all the things that you need are coming through that. So Brahma is showing that here. So again, Guru Maharaj is nicely depicting him, this dynamic that we mentioned, the dynamics of Rajaguna, which Rajaguna has a lot to do with desiring and doing and attaining, like action. And Brahma is a personification of that involvement in the world. Of course, being a devotee of Krishna, but involved in the world. And sometimes we may remain aware of the ultimate converging point of that, or sometimes those dynamics can become intense waves that carry us for a minute, distract us for some time, basically. So Rajaguna can again be expressed in such a way that it becomes sattvified, if you will, upgraded, or if not, it can degrade in the form of Tamaguna. Like, for example, you accomplish something through your action and you become proud of the result and you over-identify, I am the doer. So that becomes Tamaguna, basically. Do you follow? Through what I attain in Rajas, I go to Tamas. Or you may attain something in Sattva, and if you become proud of that, also you attain Tamas, for sure. Or you can even attain something by Bhakti, and become proud of that, and attain Tamas. That's mentioned by our acharyas. Bhakti Utanartas. You have this famous classification of anartas. One of the anartas are those which come from bhakti. And we may think, how can bhakti give anartas? Of course, bhakti is not giving anartas. But bhakti is giving some byproducts of your practice. And if you don't learn how to relate with those byproducts, you may become proud. And anarta is there. By the byproduct of bhakti that you were not able to properly translate, if you will, in your life. You follow the point, no? Before practicing bhakti, maybe you didn't have any knowledge, any followers, maybe you have some other anartas, and you start practicing bhakti, and you get rid of those anarthas you had, but you acquire new ones. Because you start to have knowledge, followers, who knows what, and you may become proud of that. Before that, you didn't have a reason to become proud of that because you didn't have any followers or any knowledge. So, you follow the point. So it's delicate because you get rid of some anarthas, but you are maybe just putting the baggage on the other shoulder by updating and acquiring new ones, and which may be more tricky because all this is in the context of what bhakti is giving to you, trusting that you will use those byproducts in a proper way. and if you are not sincere in that, in time you may really cheat yourself and externally keep a show of practice, but actually in a very confidential way, clandestine way, mm-hmm. you're just delighting internally in some secret corner of your, where is the kijai? Where is the kijai? Dopamine shot. Those are the likes version in the Gaudiya tradition. Kijai. How many kijai per day? How many likes I have in my some version of that. So again, anyhow, some ideas in regarding to how, and Brahma somehow is saying that, no? I mean, I was doing this as a service, but somehow I became proud of what I did, I became covered, and look me now. And of course, mercy is still coming, and he's properly repenting. So we should learn to reflect on our own situation while we hear all the things. I mean, we are not Brahma, but we can, maybe we have been, you never know, but we can apply these ideas. Let's continue with the all ancient commentaries of this verse, starting with Sridhar Swami. He will say, I will briefly share something from complementary or from different acharyas. So Sridhar Swami is saying, Brahma thought, I had the conceit of being a god separate from you. That's an interesting point. Because Brahma is a god in the sense of Deva. No? That's an important one. We have God and a god. No? And the gods, in plural. And the god. So Brahma is a god. So there is no problem for him being a god. But the problem here is separate from you. A god separate from the god, the supreme personality of God. That's a problem, not to be a god. To be a god is not a problem, interestingly. But to be a god separate from the god of gods, Deva Deva, as Arjuna calls Krishna in the Gita, that's the problem. Whether you are a god or whether you are a worm, separate from, that's a problem. The implication is that even if you're a god, but not separate from God, there's no problem, even being a god. Although we might say, well, that's dangerous to be a Brahman. So many things. If you don't feel yourself separate, no problem. But if you are an ant or a human being in North Carolina, no problem. But separate from, that's problem. So the separate sense of existence. Vayam dvitiya abhinivesha, says the Bhagavatam. Fear in material condition starts when we conceive ourselves in dualistic terms. In other words, we create this dichotomy, me and not me, not in connection with my source, but me and everything else, but not you with your source, separate from. Swartha, separate interest. Let's go to Sanatan Goswami's Brihad Bhagavatamrita. I'm tempted to just speak on what one commentator says, but let's go. Sanatan Goswami says, Brahma implies here, because you are so great and I am so small, you should forgive me. That's like the implication. I remember last verse, which was the analogy he gave?
Fire.
So that's pretty much cleared regarding quantity, size, no? I mean, and quality also, because it's not that with, like sometimes cities say, okay, we are like one, someone said the other day to me, I mean, we are one with Krishna, he's an ocean and we are like a drop. So all the qualities of the ocean are in the drop, therefore we have bhakti. But of course the idea is, no, all the qualities of the ocean are not in a drop. The droplet does not have waves. You cannot find jewels in the depth of the drop. You cannot so many things do with the drop. There are some things on some level, but it's not the same. So the same fire and spark, if you want to play out all the analogies you want, there are some things in common, but in quantity it's totally different, and in quality also. There are some, as Kumar said, you cannot cook with a spark. You cannot do so many things with spark that you can do with fire. So the example is pretty clear. Both quality and quantity, Brahma is establishing this difference. You are so great in every sense, and I am tatastha. I mean, that's who Brahma is, at least generally speaking. Sometimes Krishna has to enter into that pose, but generally he's a tatastha jiva. He is in this case, because he's hankering for some type of city of perfection. Then I'm marginal. I mean, not to downplay that, but just to be aware of who we are and how much we depend on our source. And then Sanatana Goswami says something interesting with the word he. He means certainly, which can be applied to one of the words that Brahma is saying, maybe, I don't know. I was certainly proud. But Sanatana Goswami says the word he, and this Sanskrit allows this to happen, and many times commentators place with this. They take one word and they will say, this word applies to every single word of the whole verse. It's qualifying every single word of the verse. So he's saying here, this Sanatana Goswami say here, the word he, certainly applies to, no, I'm certainly proud, Rama is saying. I'm certainly born in Rajas, he's saying. I certainly try to be a God separate from you. Most importantly, on top of this, you are certainly infallible in forgiving your devotees. And you certainly do so. You certainly should forgive me. Because I'm certainly your servant. So in this way, all the verse acquires more weight. No? Each expression of the verse becomes more like pounding the post. No? Pounding each word of the verse with this word. He, certainly, certainly. And Sanatana Goswami says, if at this point Krishna may reply, no, like he has done according to our commentators, remember, Krishna is in full mukdata, no, which is naivete, no, lost in Naralila. So like, what are you saying, Brahma? You are Parameshti, says Sanatana Goswami, which is the name of Brahma, like great personality in the whole universe. Why do you say you are a servant? You are almost God. So Brahma, Sanatana Goswami said, then Brahma will reply, no, you should think in this way, my Prabhu. He, Brahma, is a servant toward me, the Lord. Thus Brahma implies, you are the reason I am a servant. I am a servant so I can attain you. According to Sanatana Goswami, this is the implication of this section. You are the reason I am a servant. And I am a servant because I want to attain you. Brahma is over and over, whatever he can, he's trying to establish his longing, his focus in his prayer. Again, a prayer is not without focus. You just not pray. I mean, you pray for something. You cannot just pray generically. In an abstract way, prayer has to have some objective. So maybe at least long term, middle term, short term, different degrees of reach in the prayer. No problem with this, everything is okay. Life happens, as they say. Let's go from Sanatana Goswami to Srila Jiva Goswami, who quotes this verse in his Priti Sandarbha. Anucheda 166. And interestingly, in this section of Priti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami is speaking about the different rasas. And in this case, he's speaking about Gona rasa. Gona rasa means secondary rasas, which are seven. We have five primary rasas: Mukhya rasa, Santa, Dasya, Sakya, Batsali, Madhura, and there are seven secondary rasas: Payanaka, Hasya, Pivatsa, and so on, seven. Rodra, Karuna, and so on. So here he says, this, he quotes this verse, he says, as an example of Bhayanaka Rasa, interestingly, which is the rasa of fear. Mm-hmm. Because of having offended Bhagavan. So Brahma is fearful. Not fearful of Bhagavan, because he doesn't look like a very fearful person. He's just like, he seems even himself more afraid of this four-headed guy doing all this weird stuff in front of him. But fear, as we mentioned, of the consequences of operating connection to the object of his love. I mean, he doesn't want to lose that connection. And so in that sense, Jiva Goswami quotes this verse, Bhayanaka Rasa. And then he paraphrases in his Lagu Vaishnava Tosani, he paraphrases Brahma. And Brahma says through Jiva Goswami like this, though I think I am the master, you should think, and Brahma is saying to Krishna, you should think, Krishna, since I am the master, this is my servant, I should be merciful to him. So Brahma is telling, I mean, it's not that Brahma is telling Krishna what to think, but he's humbly saying, I'm your servant, you are my master, you should think, I mean, you shouldn't take me very seriously, I'm just your false servant, so he's my servant, he's under my care, I will be merciful to him, he belongs to me, something like this. No? And then comes this interesting idea that we want to develop today a little bit, of what does it mean to be worthy of compassion. So Jiva Goswami says, therefore, he paraphrases Brahma, therefore you should forgive me, since I'm worthy of being shown compassion. Sometimes we say it's costless. Since you are achyuta, and therefore you should be true to your word, as we mentioned before. True to your word means, you don't, one meaning of achyuta is you do not deviate from your compassion. You are always compassionate. You do not fail in being compassionate. Try to play out the implications of someone like this. That you meet in the street and, hello, what's your name? He who never fails in being compassionate. Oh my gosh, now give me a WhatsApp number. I need that connection. I want to be connected with such a person. Achyuta. He who never fails in showing compassion. Which is, in another way, means he who is at every moment becomes more compassionate, because it's not just like always remains in the same boring point of being compassionate. Because probably in many cases we have the great capacity of becoming more and more fallen, so Krishna has to complement by becoming more and more compassionate. It's not that, okay, I'm helping Krishna to become more compassionate. No, I'm doing him a favor, so he can really deserve that title. We shouldn't think like that. But Brahma is addressing him in that way. And then Jiva Goswami, in his commentary, quotes a famous verse from Ramayana, which is very generally connected with Saranagati and the idea of offering ourselves for the pleasure of Krishna. Aham tabashmi. Aham tanuban mano viraham tabashmi. Like, I'm yours in body, mind, and words. Now, this is kind of a statement of principles, no? Who we want to be. Tanuban mano viraham tabashmi. My words belong to you, my thoughts belong to you, my bodily actions belong to you. I'm not an independent speaker, thinker, doer. Again, easier said than done, but we should enter into that spirit. No? I mean, every day that passes, hopefully, we are getting closer to that offering of ourselves. No? So Brahma is trying to say that, and Jiva Goswami makes a point sharing this verse from Ramayana. When Sri Ram promises to give abhayatva, which means fearlessness. So you say, I have made a vow, Ramachandra says, you may know this verse, I will give fearlessness to that person who surrenders to me, saying once, I am yours. Aham tabashmi. Aham tabashmi means I am yours. I mean, that's pretty generous. You say just that once. This is what he said to Ravana, actually, before killing him. No, Ravana accrued lots of merit for being chastised by Ramachandra. Lots of it. So Sri Ram was pointing with his arrow just for decapitating. No, how do you say it? Yeah? All of those heads. I say, I give you one more chance. You just say, Aham Tabasmi. I'm yours. If you say that, I promise I forget everything you have done. Everything. Nothing happened. I mean, try to imagine. You have to be really compassionate to that. I mean, to delete the whole hard disk in a moment. Just say one time. Just say it once. Not even demonstrate that through acts many times. Say it once. I want to watch me. Ram said, no. Not even once. Okay. So that's the promise that Brahma is saying this in the context. I've said that more than once. So I'm your servant. Please, Ramachandra is saying here, I protect you from fear. I will give you abhayatva. And that's a term that Guru Maharaj uses a lot regarding how cowherd boys and how abhay they are. I mean, we come in the lineage of abhays. So that means no fear. So how we attain no fear? I'm yours. In other words, how you attain fear? I'm not yours. What I say before, no? What's the verse? The verse that I just say, Bayadutiya binivesatasya. The Bhagavatam says, fear comes from absorption in duality, from absorption in separate interests, ulterior motives, consciousness. Fear comes. And you try to keep everything, but no, fear comes. So Brahma is saying that, I made this vow, I'm yours, please protect me. I'm worthy of compassion. So the logic here is Brahma is worthy of being shown, should be shown grace, because Jiva Goswami said, the offense of the servant can be only be forgiven by the master. No, the servant belongs to the master, so the master will take charge of. Oh, like what Narayan showed when the Kumaras apparently did some mistake with, sorry, when Jaya Bijaya apparently did some mistake with the Kumaras. You know what happened before. We are getting closer tomorrow in the Srimha Lila, and this is the whole background of that. And Narayan himself comes and saying, what happened? What did my own ones did? And then the Kumaras realized, because they are pretty smart, they realize we actually did a mistake here. We were, the whole big situation was made here by Kuntha, creating Sakuntha, creating anxiety in the place of non-anxiety. And we thought that these two gatekeepers were the wrong ones, but we see the degree in which Bhagavan is taking responsibility for his servants. We realize they have a proximity with him that we can only think about that. We don't have a clue what that is. So they are way high above us. But the point is, Bhagavan is showing how much he takes responsibility for his devotees. So here, Brahma is saying this, I am your servant, adikritya das. Although Brahma is not establishing the fixed rasa yet, but he is called a dasa in the beginning because he's performing the architectural, creational service as a service to Bhagavan. So, of course, again, the question comes, how is one worthy of receiving costless grace? Well, that sounds like contradictory. Because costless gives the idea of there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, there's a cost in the heart of the merciful one, in one sense. But from us, so the logic here that Brahma is saying, I'm worthy of compassion because I'm worthy of your compassion. That's why I'm worthy of your compassion. I've done exactly the opposite to deserve your grace, and that's why I deserve your grace. Because that's how it operates. Costless grace is not waiting like, okay, you tell me when you deserve it, and I give it to you. It's not working like that. So Brahma is saying that. I've done exactly the opposite to deserve your grace, and that shows how much do I need your grace. And to need your grace means to deserve your grace. In one sense, we do not deserve, but you follow my point. That like this saying that sometimes it's shared, like, help me when I deserve it the less, because that's when I will be needing it the most. So the logic is not you deserve it or not. It's that you need it or not. That's the mood of Mahaprabhu, Panchatattva, Gaur Lila coming to us. Srila Siamaraja say, do not demand for justice while at the same time knocking on the door of mercy. That's like, it's a scandal. You are knocking on the door of mercy, you are entering Mahaprabhu's ranks, you want, but sometimes you may, in practical life, demand justice for others, generally. So you will be a loser by doing that. Let's go with Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's Sararth Darshan. He will continue unfolding this logic of causeless grace very nicely. He says, Brahma continues, he paraphrases Brahma. Though my bad conduct is worthy of punishment, my foolishness is worthy of forgiveness. So please be merciful and pardon me completely. Pretty boldly he is presenting his case. But with sincerity, again, it's not like he's not trying to cheat Krishna. He already tried to cheat Krishna a lot and it didn't work. So he knows it doesn't work in that direction. Do not withhold your mercy from this fallen one. Therefore, I address you as Achyuta, the infallible one. You should remember that the most fallen require more mercy, so kindly pardon my offense. And of course, we don't have only to say it, but we have to feel it in order for that to fully happen. And Brahma is really feeling that here. He's feeling, I'm the most fallen. And he was really feeling. So Prabhupada won't tell him, you are not the most anything. Because he was really feeling. So it's okay. Good. We should feel that in some point, in some way. So he's further unfolding this notion of, because of my misbehavior, I'm worthy of chastisement. But because of my foolishness, I'm worthy of forgiveness. I'm just a fool servant, like a baby. Please forgive me. So again, we don't have just to say it, but to cry the talk. Mm-hmm. And that's not so easy. But that's not impossible. Brahma further implies, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, with great pride, I think I am your son, arising from your navel. That's pretty exclusive. Who is your father? But I am blind in all 8 eyes, says Vishwanath Chakravarti. But my pride will be destroyed when the moon of your mercy shines upon me. Like now I'm in the dark night, not of my soul, but of my pride, basically. And try to imagine, like, I mean, Brahma knows what does it mean, because when Brahma was born from the lotus, there was no moon, there was no candle, there was no light. It was him on a lotus, long stem, you see? So he started like to touch the the lotus and the stem and went down to see if something was there. It's never ending, let's go back at least to have some place to sit firmly. But he was not seeing anything. We see the picture, and we see Brahma in the picture, but technically speaking, the painter has to have painted a whole black square. You follow? Because there was no light there, it was just Brahma. Then the word tapa came, so some light came, because tapa means fire. So he engaged in the fire of tapasya, and some light came out of tapasya. But before that, total darkness. But here Brahma is thinking with full humility, okay, that was total darkness. Now this is total darkness. This is even heavier darkness. Because at that moment, I didn't know about you. And now I knew, but I abused who you are. So that's a further darkness. Although I see so many things, I have so many eyes, ached. I mean, that's a further darkness than the one at the beginning of creation. So he's, again, crying and crying and crying. I'm blind with my old 8 eyes. I cannot see it. And he's crying with all his 8 eyes. So then we believe Brahma is being serious about what he's saying. You know? Because if I tell you, I'm blind to see who you are, but no tears are coming, I mean, you are blind. Actually, you are blind much more because you're not being that sincere. If you really feel that, tears will come and blind you. You will be blinded by tears. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur concludes, how will forgiveness manifest? Krishna should consider, out of foolishness, Brahma made a show of independence in front of me. But in truth, Brahma is controlled because of dependence of my on my energy. Therefore, I should show him mercy. And so Brahma is asking for mercy. And what's the ultimate mercy that Brahma wants to attain? You tell me.
He wants to be defended.
So some of the commentators have commented this with the word Rajabhubha in this verse, which again, generally Rajabhubha means born in Rajaguna. But also, Rajabhubha means Raja, can also mean dust. You have heard in Vrindavan, Braja Raj. No? Raj. So Raj means dust in this case. So Rajabhubha means, Bhuva means also place, remember. Rajabhubha will mean whose place is Rajas. So whose place is the dust. So Brahma is asking here for the dust of Vrindavan. He will make that clear. That's the ultimate goal Brahma wants to attain. In verse 34, reaching its end, Brahma will famously pray to be born in any whatever situation. Of course, he wants something in particular, but in his humility, he will pray for whatever birth available, even as a speck of dust, but in Vrindavan. So here he's given this trailer of that by saying, Rajabhubha, give me a place in the dust. I mean, he has his face in the dust now. Remember, he fell from the swan. The devas never touched the ground on earth. Brahma transgressed that rule. He left his condition as a deva. He put his head, four heads taking turns on the ground of Vrindavan while offering pranam to Krishna. So, I mean, he already attained the dust, literally, but he wants to attain the dust of Braj in a more substantial way. Now, give me a position in this, arena of service. So in this way, we see how this Brahma in this verse have very exemplarily engaged in what we may call the crying yoga or the art of devotional lamentation. So I'd like to share some concluding words on the concept of crying yoga if you give me time. Do we have eternity still available? Okay, right. Nityam Bhagavata Shivaya. Okay. So we can speak about levels of sorry, if we speak about crying, of course we are speaking about tears. And if we speak about tears, we will speak about degrees of tears. Not like a hierarchy, a tear hierarchy or something. No, a hierarchy of crying, if you will. So let's speak about three levels of tears that you may imagine already in which direction it will go. To begin with, we have the tears or the crying of the Baddha Jiva, or the conditioned soul. In other words, we spoke about that last class, unnecessary lamentation, like how Krishna chastised Arjuna in the Gita right at the beginning. Your tears are not worthy of being expressed, no? Save that water for something else. Something like that, no? No. You are lamenting for those things which are not worthy of lamentation. Anarya. Indicating there are some things your tears are worthy. There are some other things worthy of your tears, like that you say? Okay. So that's what we are after. We could say the meaning of life is to discover which is that thing that is worthy of our tears. What to do with my tears? That's the existential question. You have some tears. We are not showing that because generally we are pretty much ashamed of crying in front of the public. but we have a crying potential. And of course, as we know, in the Baddha Jiva, that's not expressed in the most virtuous way. That was Krishna saying to Arjuna, Masuchaha, at the beginning, Masuchaha, at the end, do not lament. Do not lament again in this particular unnecessary way. Do not fear. All these connections are there. Do not. Unnecessary lamentation is tied with fear. And again, conditioned world, this material world has to do with with that type of crying, basically. That's the norm of conditional existence. No? Sometimes it is seen, I mean, maybe Gaurangi Priya will know about this, because you are pretty much engaged with laboring, helping people being born, no? So when a child gets born, and if the child is not crying, generally the doctor will like slap, so something is wrong, he has to cry, no? Because we are being welcomed to crying worlds, no? Basically. That's another way you can describe Marte Loca, no? Welcome to crying world, not Disney World, crying world. And sometimes if the child eventually learns the lesson and starts to cry a lot in front of us, many of us adults, we don't like to see that. We feel, take the child out of my sight. No? Because actually he's showing how we as conditioned souls, no, may be feeling, but we don't want to acknowledge that publicly and just cry. But when someone is doing that without filter, it's like, oh my gosh, no, it's too much out of my comfort zone. No? So put the child in the room or something, because it's a very heavy mirror showing what I should be doing, but I'm not willing to do that. So again, that's the Baddha Jiva's quote-unquote lamentation. It's not the real lamentation in one sense. It's a false one. Of course, on the other extreme of the pendulum, we have the lamentation of the Siddha, no? Or the perfected being. Then we go to our situation. So we have the lamentation of that person who is desperate in separation from Krishna, as Krishna says in the Gita, paritranaya sadunam vinachaya saduskritam dharma samstapana artaya sambhavami juge juge. So what's Krishna saying in the first line? You can do it.
To deliver the pious.
Yeah. That's my way of translating, yeah. Something appeared here, sorry. 1 second. Anyhow. So Krishna says, I come to protect, to protect my devotees. Thank you so much. Soundtrack in place. Thank you. I hope you are not feeling uncomfortable. You are no longer Baddha Jivas. You should feel, you are Satakas, which is in between Baddha Jiva and Siddha, so you should find a taste. There is sweetness in crying, as we will see. Mm-hmm. Okay, volume gets higher to make the point. I mean, God exists, you can see, everything is perfect in place. So Krishna is saying, I come to protect my devotees. But of course we can say, why Krishna comes to protect his devotees? Because a devotee is someone known for having taken shelter in Krishna. So he took shelter in Krishna, he already made the promise, I'll protect you. So why Krishna has to protect his devotees? You follow the logic? But of course the logic is, he's coming to protect those devotees who can no longer live in separation from him. So he comes to protect them from themselves, if you will. Of the impending separation, like Mahaprabhu, of course he's not a devotee, I mean he is and he's not, in the Gambira, no? He was showing extreme degrees of this type of tears and crying. Sunjaitam jagat, what's the verse? Yugaitam nimeshena chakshusapa vrisaitam. No, his crying is compared to a torrential flood. No, sometimes his crying was compared like to, how is it in English, syringes? Mm-hmm. When you throw water with a syringe, it's like, it's not like, like powerful. No? So he will worship the deity like that. No, that was the Abhishek. No, it was no need to, I need to get the paraphernalia. It was all organically present in his own sattvic vows. So divine madness. No, divine madness. Of course, when people in this world cannot understand something, and cannot find a reference to something, they will call generally madness. A point of reference to whatever they know, oh, that's madness. Mm-hmm. And generally, interestingly, even madness in this world is caused by separation also. People who go mad, materially speaking, because of separation from family or work or money, or and they short circuit. So interestingly, it's to be separated from something that is difficult to continue living without. You follow my point? because you got so much whatever attached to that that it's not there. You cannot conceive your life without it. So of course that has its application here, but that has its application in the ultimate sense in relation to God. So that's the crying of the Siddha, no? Divine madness, divine mad. Divine madness is for us the highest form of sanity, actually. That's free will. You have to choose which type of madness you embrace, basically. So that's to be situated in reality. To be dhira, to be a sober person, ultimately means attaining divine madness. Bhagavan himself is crying in his lila. Especially Mahaprabhu, as Guru Maharaj likes to quote from Lord Chandas Thakur, when he's going to take sannyas, leaving his house in Navadvip, and Vishnupriya is there, just about to collapse. And he's saying, "What, in this lila we all have to cry. You will be crying, I'll be crying, everyone will be crying. That's the price to be part of Gaur Lila." So those are the tears of the perfected being. And again, in between Bhada Jiva and Siddha, we have Sadhaka. So there are some tears waiting for us as well. It's not that I'm in between, so middle point means no crying. Only the extreme fellows will cry for their respective reasons or something. No, some tears are assigned to our stage as well. There is a place for lamentation and different degrees even. And Brahma is an example of that here. Again, Brahma is not the Bhada Jiva. Brahma is not the Siddha. Brahma is someone who is wanting to attain sadhana siddhi, perfection through practice. So, and there is a crying corresponding to that. And of course, different levels of crying for the sadhaka. In many ways, we need to, again, to have some particular fall, like what Richard Rohr would call falling upward, no? and those things will help us to approach Bhagavan in a more sincere way. Like Kunti Devi saying, "Tvama kinchana gocharam janamaishwarya srita srivir idhamana madapumam naibarhatya vidatum bhai. Tvama kinchana gocharam." Those who are extremely charmed by Janma, Aishwarya, Shruta, Srivir, well, good birth, opulence, knowledge, and beauty, cannot approach you with a sincere heart. You are only approachable, you are akinchana gocharam, he said. Prabhupada used the word, he who is can be approached by the one who has been materially exhausted. Which doesn't mean you have to become homeless and live under a tree, but just to get some realization of the reach of inert matter to fulfill your dreams, if you will. There's a limit to that reach, and you have to be exhausted at one point and prove, okay, this has a place, I can drive my car, I can still live in my house, but I cannot project eternal bliss with something that will disappear at any moment. No, so I have to invest that prospect, myself in that prospect, in another bank, the Brinda bank. That's where we have invested in that direction. And we have to be sincere again about this. And sometimes again, being sincere means, and crying with proper repentance have to do with recognizing our faults and all things that require repair. No? How is this when the car in the race is running, and they go for a while and they change the tier and
pit stop.
Mm-hmm. So we have our pit stops in the Bhajan Kriya. So we are at some point one wheel is like some fire can like go emergency pit stop. We have to change. But if we take proper shelter in the sadhus will be pretty effective, as those people in the race that are like very quickly put everything, okay, like continue. You don't have to do anything. You have to just to enter that point and to allow them to do their job. They are pretty quick in their job, but you have to go to that place when the car is getting on fire. You have to acknowledge, disaster is coming, so I need to go to the right place. The rest will be taken care of the experts, basically. But that's our part, no? Sincerity, as we always made this example. I think I made it, but I will make it again and again and again with your permission. The word sincerity or sincere, in Spanish is similar, sincero, sincera. And this comes from the Latin, which is sincera. Sincera. In English, you don't connect that, but in Latin or in Spanish, sin sera means without sin, sera means wax. Wax?
Wax.
Wax. So it comes from this time where they were, at those times where Latin was the norm, they were selling these big pieces of marble for people to carve in the markets. So sometimes some of the pieces will have some crack. So the vicious, I mean, part of being vicious, you can lie in that context. They were like covering the cracks with wax, white wax. So you see the piece, oh, that's like paka, perfect. Give me that one. So you start carving, and when you go into the crack, it's over. You follow. So there was another section of the market which was more sincere and more honest, and they say, here is the piece, here are all the crackings, sincera, which means without wax. Now, I'm not trying to cover up the mess. No, but the mess is there, and you work including the mess. Now, you make the work of art with the mess as part of it. You follow? Acknowledging the mess, you carve your best version of yourself. And the mess will be part of the final work. It will be there, the crack. But it won't be any longer as a cracking. When you see the piece of art, you won't see, oh, there's a crack in there. Because you did it in such a way that the cracking is contributing to the result. So, interestingly, the word sincera comes from there. No wax. No need to cover and present myself like something I'm not, basically. Now, we should be willing to recognize all that we can be, but also we should recognize who we are now and not create something we are not. You follow? We can do all, we can be all this, but at present, there are some things I'm not yet, and I shouldn't make a show. So, again, there is a place for crying in the context of that sincerity. Now, crying not necessarily implies water, but proper lamentation as a sadaka in acknowledging. But again, acknowledging the cracker, the crack means also I can make a piece of art, including the crack. So let's see how we can dovetail this particular tendency in connection with the center. So,
and Guru Maharaj talks about how in, I think it was Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Would crack, they would fill it with gold.
Yeah, what's the name of that?
Kintsugi.
Yeah, Kintsugi. That's the name of the art. Yeah, instead of not only covering that, but highlighting the crack, no? Like trying to create awareness of the trajectory of that particular object. No, it has its timeline of its own. It has trajectory. So our scars are part of of our history. Now need to whatever. To escape from the past, if you will. No? There is no saint without the past. They say, no? And there's another part to the quote, but that's the main part here. So there's place for crying again. And as the famous story is when the devotee, when Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta was mentioning this once, and the devotee say, and he was saying, we have to cry. And he probably was crying when saying that. He was not an emotional person in the sense of cheap sentimentalism. He actually tried to restrain many times his bhav, but sometimes it couldn't contain, and he would say, we have to cry. And the devotees ask him, and what if I cannot cry? Because it's not just, okay, forcing and pressing a button and bringing a whip and somehow we have to cry. And he say, what? Then you have to cry because you cannot cry. Again, it's not necessarily forcing the water to come here, because you can go to a theater school and learn how to do that, but no? Lament because you are not lamenting because due to those things who are worthy of lamenting or something like that. No? And again, sorry for becoming too nuanced, but all this is in the context of, again, of some form of celebration, because we are engaged in kirtan, which means celebration. And Srila Prabhupada on one side would say, chant and be happy, and on another side say, the chanting is like the genuine cry of a child. So now you have to put all those things together. No? I have to be happy while crying. It seems contradictory, but it's possible. It's possible to find, as Srila Sarvamana said, sweetness in pain. Another way of putting that. But that requires another mode of thinking to enter into that. No, once one devotee told that I think the place where Christ was crucified, I don't remember the exact name, but a certain flower came. And they say that, I don't know if it's poetically or what, but there's a particular flower, I cannot remember the name now, which is said that came as a result of the tears of Mother Mary. So her tears created the flower. Now, in other words, suffering created fragrance. No? Pain created sweetness. Now again, to connect, to tie one with the other and one as a result of that, that requires another way of thinking, because generally we are, I don't want to suffer. I came here to stop suffering. Artha Jignasu, Artha Artikur, just in the Gita. Most of the people who approach me come from the afflicted club, no? Afflicted assembly or whatever, no? So there's a way, there's a place for suffering, as we say, no? Krishna Bhakta Viraha Bina Dukkha Nahyar, when Mahaprabhu asked Ramananda Roy, what's the greatest suffering? Say, to be in separation from the Vaishnavas is the greatest suffering. He didn't say there's no suffering. So crying is the goal, but crying is the way, if you will. No? There's this famous example, once some Bamsidas Babaji was giving Harikata. Have you heard about Bamsidas Babaji? It's a very unique personality, Abadut. And once he was said he was giving Harikata, and someone came and made a question, like some of these classical questions, like Babaji Maharaj, how we can conduct in our daily lives so eventually we can attain the goal of bhakti. So the question was longer than the answer. He gave maybe the shortest Harikata, Guinness records in the history of the... He only replied giving one word. His reply was cry. End of the class. Prasad, go, Hari. Of course, coming from someone like Bamsidas Babaji, I imagine the ones who heard that was like, okay, I have to do something with that word now. No? To cry. How can I see Krishna cry? No? And Gaur Govinda Swami also, he opened the temple. See, I am opening crying school here. That's what an ashram is. We come here to learn to cry. Or to make sense of pain, to find the sweetness there. No? When we hear about the things of pain, separation, many may think, oh, I don't want that. I want just to be happy, which many times translates as enjoy Krishna consciousness. And that basically shows we don't know yet how to love. And it's okay in the sense of it's not so easy to know how to love. That's an art, as Eric Fromm put it. The art of, have you read the book? The Art of Loving, he says. That's an interesting one. He doesn't reach to this point, but he makes a very interesting point about what love is not. Actually, he mostly speaks about what love is not, because first he needs to deconstruct all the notions we have what love is, and it's very strong. And then he starts to speak. So sometimes, yeah, because not knowing how the art of love, we may not be able to find this sweetness in pain, in separation. So we need to learn, basically, as sadhakas, we need to learn to cry, and Sri Guru is there for us. We need Srila Gurudev to learn to cry, basically. And that's what we call bhajan, technically speaking. No, I'm trying to learn to cry by the grace of Srila Gurudev. No? Bhajan is not like a cheap word, like, how is your bhajan? Oh, nice. What does it mean? What do you mean by nice? Sometimes nice means I've still not broken any regulative principles. That's not the right answer to the question. Probably if your bhajan is doing nice, you won't say nice. Because there's so much to do, so much to mind. Again, without neurosis, without complacency, middle path. So that's bhajan. No? Learn to cry, taking the hand of Srila Gurudev and the sadhus. No? We are in that stage, work in progress. So that's real kirtan, basically. Kirtan is a form of crying. I mean, there's no kirtan, Mahaprabhu, there's no kirtan in which Mahaprabhu and his associates were not crying. That was, I mean, one thing was the other. It's the synonym. So mm-hmm. it's not like, okay, kirtan and no tears, there's no kirtan for them. Like, what? So, yeah. And again, kirtan is not loud kirtan, heavy kirtan, ecstatic kirtan. Doesn't mean just like jumping like monkeys and shouting at the top of our lung. Or, oh, the kirtan was ecstatic. Sometimes I heard the words like, how you saw that kirtan was so... And maybe you said that was rajasic, basically. And that's not the same thing, ecstatic. I mean, there can be ecstatic kirtans, I'm not denying that. But it can be rajasic ones. And we shouldn't mistake one thing at the other. No, I mean, it's okay, you are dovetailing rajaguna in the context of kirtan and sadhusanga instead of doing who knows which nonsense. But that's not the prem sankirtan, the passionate sankirtan Mahaprabhu was engaged in. And maybe you are sincerely praying in your room, inside your closet, sincerely praying to Krishna and just dropping one single tear. And that single tear is much more loud and powerful than a whole kirtan with 108 mridangas and 3,000 harmoniums and who knows what. No. That will reach Krishna's heart much more effectively. To follow, I mean, I'm not saying that cannot happen in a loud kirtan. I'm saying just it's not about how loud it sounds and how many people was there, but how much crying was going on internally. Again, it's all internal, and sometimes it overflows externally, but it begins internally. Even nobody hear that. That's my point. Nobody hear that tear falling. Except for Krishna. Except for the one whose our tears are... He's worthy of our tears, basically. He hears that tear and he's doing something about that. You can do a very like tumultuous kirtan. Maybe many hear that. It's streaming online. Hundreds of people. Wow, like such a kirtaniya. But maybe it didn't touch Krishna's heart because crying wasn't there. So... Anyhow, some words on the crying yoga. So, napkins in place. And in the next verse, that will be shared from Michigan. So, see you in that. Not see you Zoom, because I'm no longer using Zoom now. But see you somehow. YouTube, Facebook, online. Or you're invited to join us there. Brahma will continue to unfold his humility. Again, it's not here. This is not the end. In one sense, technically speaking, there is no end, and every single prayer is an upgraded humility. So here in the next verse, he will compare his position with that of Krishna. He's contrasting this over and over again. Spark and fire, achyuta and chyuta, master and servant. So he will continue establishing the position of his deity and establishing his position of the servant of the deity more and more comprehensively, as a foundation that will allow his Sakyarasa project to blossom, basically. So, reaching new and new heights in the last verses. But we'll finish here. Unless there is some question. We have some minutes. Any questions from you or from the one connected online? Here we have Krishna Priya connected. Sending one question, and the devotee here is sending greetings to her. So she's asking, how to turn material lamentation and separation to spiritual yearning? Yeah, that's the question, because he made it twice. Well, as you may imagine, this is not something that it's an automatic pill you swallow and we are there. And that's why I mentioned this point that we need the crying ones in our lives to learn how to cry. You know? We need Sri Guru to learn to cry for Krishna. So we learned. We need to get closer to the heart of those who are crying for Krishna. Basically, that's the way we can learn to cry for Krishna ourselves. You know? It's to put it in simple words. You know? I mean, we need to be, because again, crying for Krishna is a totally unknown experience for a Bada Jiva. And to learn to lament for the proper things, that's not so easy. That's a huge lesson. So we need close association and close example how that it takes place, how that expresses itself in daily life. And of course, there are so many prayers that our acharyas have shared with us, that they are really, I mean, if you study Bhaktivinoda Thakur's prayers, Kanwar Tamdas Thakur's prayers, they were not just like, it's not the Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writing Kandiya, Kandiya, just writing it, which means crying and crying. And it's not, I will write a song and I will, and I'm crying and crying. I mean, while I'm drinking one like 7-Up or whatever, and what else can I put? And I'm rolling on the ground. And he first cries and then he gets up and maybe writes something. He rolls on the ground and then he extends that experience in written form, not the opposite way around. I'll write it. Okay, I'll roll so as to not be an hypocrite. Okay, I did it after. So I will say that combination, no? to connect with those prayers, or like these prayers. I mean, the Bhagavatam is full of prayers. I mean, I don't know if someone ever counted how many verses of the Bhagavatam are actual prayers, but I mean, that's a huge percentage of the whole book. So that's an important point the Bhagavatam wants to make. It's not just a casual thing, no? So many prayers. You need to learn. You need to pray and you need to learn how to pray. So you need to hear from those who are doing that from a proper place. And you can even memorize and learn those prayers and trying to make them yours. Because that's the whole idea. It's not just repetition. Rama say, tati, nukampam, susam. No, it's like, how do I... Appropriation, you say? No? Prayer appropriation? Not cultural appropriation, but... Okay, it's their prayers. I mean, not appropriation in the way that I created this verse and I put my name, but how this enters into my heart and churns my own situation. I mean, that's how we should go through Shastra and these songs. It's not just like, oh, this is Bhaktivinoda Thakur. This is not me. Oh, this is Narottam Das Thakur. Oh, they are suffering so much, poor of them. Something like this. We should think how this is relevant to me. If it's not relevant to me, what's the meaning of doing that? I mean, what's the meaning of singing the whole Saranagati if I conclude, that was for Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I had nothing to do with that. I mean, you lost 3 hours of your life by not connecting with that. So I think we these two things, trying to connect, trying to learn and sing and connect with these songs and prayers, and especially hear them, receive them, understand them from the hearts and mouths and sacred lips of those who are already there on some level, who are crying for Krishna, who are crying, lamenting for that what is worthy of lamentation. So this combination is pretty powerful. If you get closer to a sadhu who knows how to do this, and you hear from his, her lips, sadhu, sadhvi, this difference, or new prayers, of course, not just what is there in the book, but I mean, so many things come according to what one situation, there may be a particular prayer coming in our heart. That's important, and that's one of the limbs of bhakti, Swarup Siddha Bhakti, Vandanam. We shouldn't forget to pray. And sometimes one thing is chanting. You know, you are chanting and you are trying to meditate on the sound, trying to concentrate on the name. But something separate can be to pray. I mean, I'm not totally separating the two, but I'm saying there is place for praying. You don't need to be saying Hare Krishna every time you are praying. You can pray without japa mala in your hand. And sometimes that can help you even more to focus your prayer and to really invest yourself of the proper mood and emotion to direct your prayer. And of course, you chant also, but these different limbs of angas of bhakti are there. So, but yeah, ideally receiving some scars from those sadhus who are there. And it's a gradual process. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is this prayer today a deepening of this tete nukam pam prayer? It's one who is earnestly waiting for the mercy of the Lord
to
be bestowed.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like he's praying more deeply now. You have to give him this mercy.
Yeah. Of course. Yes, we mentioned each one of these verses are like Brahma is upgrading his epiphany. No? So whatever he said before is included in this plus something else. plus something else. Like Guru Maharaj will say, no, the verses of Sikshastakam represent different stages of bhakti, and each stage is somehow including the previous ones. So in the third verse, Mahaprabhu is showing a degree of humility, but it doesn't mean that humility stops in the third verse of Sikshastakam. Of course, it's especially important for us because it shows the goal to attain in a relatively, hopefully, short period, one lifetime at least. But all the other verses are speaking about other degrees of humility. It's not the 7th, 8th verses. Mahaprabhu is not that humble there or something. He's much more humble, but maybe that humility is so big that we may not be able to relate and to find humility there because we are quite far from that. So we think, oh, 3rd verse, oh, that's really about humility because we can relate with that and it's okay. But when you reach there, you see, oh, 4th verse is about higher humility, and fifth, so this, yeah, like the same, no? And at the end of these prayers, again, Brahma will say, I just pray to be born a speck of dust in Braj, and aho bhagyam, nanda gopa, brajokasram, jammitra, how fortunate is the people of Braj, and he starts to appreciate the situation of Krishna's friends, and all those things are upgraded versions of Brahma's first statements, if you will, humility and so many other things. So yeah, we can see them as a crescendo, if you will. And that should happen with us as well, ideally. If you are praying, and you keep praying, and you keep praying, ideally that will be some form of crescendo as well. It's not that you pray very intensely and after years everything goes like, till no more prayer. No, the opposite. So he's showing that here also. Okay. Amal Sham, yeah.
Yeah, one more. You had mentioned how, like, a word in English has like 108 meanings in Sanskrit, and then I know you were just, giving an example, and how a word of Sanskrit has like so many different meanings.
Yeah.
So the word that comes to my mind is avidya, which we loosely translate to being ignorance, and what my understanding is that ignorance has like there's like ignorance, and then there's false knowledge, there's like there's right knowledge, false knowledge, and ignorance, and it seems like I'm wondering if the word avidya sometimes could mean false knowledge, which is different from ignorance, because if I was born in the darkness of ignorance, it's not a bad thing, at least I'm admitting that I'm ignorant. Like if I admit that I don't know, that's better than just carrying a life like I know. But really, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that avidya, if when we translate it or when we read it, maybe it has more meaning than just saying ignorance, because I really feel like ignorance is not a bad thing.
Let's keep healing generational traumas through our Gaudiya glossary. Now the term is avidya. We have to give a series of lectures of...
I speak for avidya.
Next time we'll make a series of lectures, healing generational trauma through the Gaudiya glossary. It may sound like, what? So we'll speak about, no? Offense, avidya, whatever. You may have sutra,
karmi.
Fallen, whatever.
Karmi.
Maya.
Woman.
Yeah, anyhow. That's a good one. Oh, yeah.
Guru.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
all of them can be totally misread. Yeah. So I just checked quickly in that Sanskrit dictionary, abhidya appears here immediately, 30 meanings. So, of course, many of them are kind of related to this notion, like uneducated, lack of knowledge, or ignorant, or absent of information. So, yeah, I would say that avidya, of course, is as you know, vidya means knowledge. So a in Sanskrit represents like the, how say, antonym?
Antonym.
The opposite word. You have many words like this, agyan, as you say, omagyan, abidya, and similar words. So knowledge, abidya means, sometimes translated as, yes, ignorance, so we could say lack of knowledge. And of course, lack of knowledge also can, we have to further clarify, what does it mean, lack of knowledge? Because even if I think I have lots of knowledge, well, I don't, that's lack of knowledge. And if I have lack of knowledge and acknowledge, there's still lack of knowledge, but there's a type of knowledge in acknowledging your lack of knowledge, like Socrates said, no? The only thing I know is that I don't know. I just to know pretty much, because there are, I mean, the things that we ignore are much more than the things that we know. And again, it's not for us about knowing many things, but knowing what really needs to be known, because if not, Google has so much more knowledge than all of us put together, no? And sometimes we trust him as our guru, basically. Instead of asking Gurudev, you go to Google. But my point is, yeah, I would say there are degrees of ignorance. Now, we can speak of ignorance as, I don't know something, and it's okay, as you mentioned, that's not necessarily something wrong to not know everything. That won't happen. But generally, again, it's very much contextual, you say? Mm-hmm. And Sanskrit in itself is very contextual. That's an important, interesting point. I'm starting to learn Sanskrit at a very basic level, and a very interesting idea that I got, and maybe even if I do not learn anything else, that was worthy the whole learning, apart from learning the Devanagari, who took some time. But the idea that the words in a Sanskrit verse or prayer can be in different order. It's not like in English grammar, there has to be some order, or in Spanish. Sanskrit, that can be anywhere. So, and the question is, of course, how do I know what's the meaning of the sentence? By understanding the context. If you take the context out, you don't have a clue what's going on. So, the point is, Sanskrit is a language that is absolutely sensitive to the context. That's a very interesting thing, because it tells something about life. No? I mean, don't take things out of context, because they mean nothing. They stop having real value. So my point with this is, we say ignorance, and sometimes we have this mistake of rushing to conclude, okay, this means something, this, I know what the ignorance means, boom. But if you say avidya in Sanskrit, they will say, you say, what does it mean, avidya? And probably they will ask, you have to tell me the whole, the rest of the sentence. Right. If not, I don't know. That's avidya, I don't know. So that's and that's important. It helps us not to rush and quickly like reach conclusions. I know this, how this means this, and engage in prejudice and judging other people. He said that word. In Sanskrit, it's much more like pause. Like, let's see the bigger picture, let's see the context. And only then we can figure out what actually the word meant in this particular case. So again, we translate such a context-dependent word, avidya, to our not-so-much-context-dependent language, and we say ignorance. Again, for many, ignorance is already a given. And the problem is that many people may have a different idea even, what does it mean, but they only have that idea. So that's even more problematic. Because it's not that we all have the same idea about what ignorance means, and we agree in that, although we are all wrong. But we agree, and we all are fighting with each other because we disagree what ignorance means, and all of us are wrong in the two levels, about what it means and because we disagree with each other. So I know that may not be a very popular system to promote, but I will say that. No, you say ignorance. What's the meaning of ignorance? Someone asks you in English. I say, I don't know. You have to give me the whole sentence, because there can be so many ways. It can mean, I don't know something, which is okay. It can mean, I think I know something, while I don't, which is not that okay. Of course, in a devotional sense, many times, avidya or ignorance will mostly refer to not being Krishna conscious in a very general way. So ignoring who you are and who is your source. And if you know that, there is no ignorance, but it's a very, again, generic way of using the term, which sometimes terms are used generically. So yeah, there is place for all those things, and as you mentioned, especially, I like the point, there's place for acknowledging I'm in ignorance, and that shouldn't be a problem. Of course, I'm ignorance of what? No? Because, of course, we can be in ignorance about what's the weather now in Greenland, and it's okay, our life goes on. But the point is, if I'm ignorant about some other things which are pretty crucial, that can be a problem, and that's not like, okay, I'm in ignorance, it's okay, no problem. You follow my point. But, of course, we may say, no, you shouldn't be ignorant of Krishna. Yes, okay, and we are not on some level, but we are in the context of that, we are still ignorant of so many things that still we will be continue being ignorant for some time, and it's part of the learning curve, no problem. So we shouldn't go neurotic also about not being ignorant in any sense of the term, because that can also become some, like, egoic quest for perfection. I don't want to be ignorant in any way. You're being ignorant by thinking like that. Because perfection is a demand of the ego, not of the heart. So, but also that's not an excuse for being lazy. No? I'm ignorant and I'm okay. I won't learn. I won't study. No? Because Krishna Das Kaviraj says, but Siddhanta valiye chitte na kara alas. No? You have to learn Siddhanta. Don't be lazy. Oh, but I'm ignorant, I'm okay, don't be lazy. So all the things have to be like put together and see how to apply in each particular circumstance, yeah.
I was wondering if ignorance is related to the modes as well, because like you could say ignorance in the mode of goodness is like I don't know, and then passion and tamagun.
Yeah, of course, generally ignorance is tied with tamagun. It's officially called the mode of ignorance. And in that sense, the word is tamas, which actually means darkness. So the mode of darkness. But sometimes that's tied with ignorance. Again, that's how words connect with each other. But it's not that in Rajaguna there is no ignorance. And technically speaking, in sattva, although sattva guna is characterized by knowledge, which is the opposite of ignorance, that's still, we can speak in one sense, there's a form of ignorance because it's sattva. Sattva is still maya shakti. Maya shakti is made of sattva, rajas, tamas. So sattva still is maya shakti, a very refined version of it, but still there's ignorance in that sense. I mean, you can be fully sattvic and be an atheist. To give an example, no? And that's a form of ignorance. But sattva is characterized by knowledge. But it doesn't mean that, again, you are not ignorant while being characterized by knowledge. So, and it's not black and white, again, it's so many degrees of having coexisting with the two of them, basically. It will always happen. I mean, if you become aware of Krishna, as we say, you look at Krishna, you give your back to Maya, for putting in simple terms. So you become focused in something, you become distracted on some other things. So you know something, you ignore something else. In Vrindavan, they will ignore the fact that Krishna is God. That's pretty ignorant. Divine ignorance, we call. So that's another way of saying, it's okay to be ignorant. Gyan sunya bhakti, already Brahma spoke like that in the third verse. Gyan prayasada apasyana manta eva. I totally reject gyan, knowledge, and just put my head to the ground of this Krishna. Brain dead bhakti, as Srila Samaras will call. That's pretty big promotion of a form of ignorance. So again, there's place for all these things in perfection. For crying, for suffering, for pain, for ignorance. Krishna Lila integrates them all. That's pretty much, there's lots of, that's why Braj is Jiva Goswami said, that's the place where all things are possible. All things are accommodated by the level of love and harmony. Even ignorance. And not only a little place, big place. Nobody knows Krishna is God. In Vaikuntha, everybody knows Krishna is God. In Vrindavan, nobody knows Krishna is God. That has to be a pretty dense layer of divine ignorance. So, Avidya ki jai. Srila Gurudev ki jai. Srimad Mahaprabhu ki jai. Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Premananda. Hari Hari Bo. Vancha Kalpatarubhyasya Kripasindubhyai Vachapatitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namah. Ananta Koti Vaishnavrinda ki jai. Gaur Hari Bo.